I'm your host, Jenny Worthington, and I will be introducing you to people and organizations around the world who are working for animal welfare. We're being called to participate in making the world a better place, and the people I will be talking with are on the front lines of critical work that we need to know about so that we can support them. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening. Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of Hello Animal Talks, where I'm spotlighting people and organizations around the world who are doing incredible work for animals. And today, I'm thrilled to have with me Carson Barlock, who is part of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. She is the campaign and policy leader for them, specifically working with the big cats. She has a degree, I believe it specializes in environmental science, and a BA in chemistry. And she does policy work for these wild animals, specifically the captive wildlife trade, promoting human-wildlife coexistence and advancing protections for imperiled species. And she's leading International Fund for Animal Welfare's United States Big Cat Policy Campaign and spearheading the wildlife policy efforts related to trapping and predator control reform. That's a big list of things, Carson. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction.
Absolutely. I would love to hear about the big cat issue in the United States. It's sort of the last place you would expect to have big cat issues, because when I think of the U.S., I think of mountain lions and bobcats. And I can't really think of other big cats in the U.S., but that is not the issue that we're dealing with necessarily.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Most of the big cats that I deal with in the policy context are not native to the U.S. And so, like you, most people are surprised to learn that there are an estimated, we don't know exact numbers, but it's estimated that there are thousands of big cats, lions, tigers, leopards, jaguars, and other very large dangerous felids in cages across the U.S. And those range from private menageries to what people consider to be pets, but certainly we would never hope for them to have as pets, as well as captivity in sanctuaries where some of these animals have been rescued to and are actually being cared for appropriately for their lifetimes.
Do circuses and zoos play a part in that, this problem?
So really what that comes down to is the terminology. When people say zoo, they think of a wide range of facilities. We partner from time to time with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA, and they operate what we consider to be qualified zoos. They have conservation breeding programs. They work alongside us to try and bring an end to the so-called pet trade in dangerous big cats. But then there are also facilities that call themselves zoos, but are in fact very poorly managed, you know, private menageries that are exploiting animals, some of which are allowing the public to come into contact with these deadly animals, offering photo ops with cubs, lion cubs, juvenile tigers, and other dangerous animals, which is not only very inhumane for the animals, but very dangerous for the public. And so, for people hoping to visit a zoo, we encourage them to go to a facility operated by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And the same applies really in the sanctuary context as well. Unfortunately, you can't just judge a book by its cover when it comes to what a facility calls itself. So we also try to offer guidance on how people can select a proper sanctuary.
Right. I saw you had a place on your website that you could click on that would give you criteria for what really constitutes a valid sanctuary. And so can you list off some of those criteria just off the top of your head?
Sure. So one of the first things that we tend to say, and our partner sanctuaries tend to say, is our partner sanctuaries are trying to put themselves out of business. We're working together toward a day when sanctuaries are no longer needed, when there is no longer a captive big cats crisis in the United States. Some of the key features you can use to distinguish a true sanctuary from what we call a pseudo sanctuary are direct contact. That's a huge one. If you are allowed to come into contact with a lion, tiger, or other dangerous big cat, or you see people at the facility in a non-veterinary context handling those animals, that's an absolute red flag. Do not patronize that facility.
Does that include the owners?
Yes.
Okay.
Again, in a non-veterinary context, nobody should be coming into contact. Nobody should be in the enclosure. And that really underscores the point that no matter how long these animals have been fed by people, how long, whether they've been captive bred, which most all in the U.S. really have, there's no way to domesticate these wild animals. They are inherently wild. They will be dangerous for their entire lives, and there's just no way to make them safe. In addition to looking for this direct contact red flag, something people can look out for is breeding. Are you seeing a large number of cubs or really any juveniles? On rare occasions, true sanctuaries will rescue a pregnant female and they will end up with a cub or a couple of cubs at a facility. But generally, if you're seeing litters of cubs, you are in a place that is, and it's not an AZA conservation breeding program, then you are in a place that's engaging in activities that we discourage. True sanctuaries are there to provide lifetime care for animals that have been rescued from inhumane conditions, and they're not trying to add more animals to those populations.
Right, right.
They also won't be displaying them offsite. So if you see them marketing, different acts where you can come visit them at different parts of your city, then that is not a true sanctuary. And if they're operating on a for-profit basis, that's generally not a true sanctuary.
One of the things your website mentions is when these places that are not true sanctuaries are displaying cubs and letting people come in and handle them. One of the issues is that these cubs grow up and they grow pretty fast, and then they become not viable for handling by the public. And so these places have to keep churning out new cubs in order to keep their business going and putting aside the older animals. So what exactly happens to these older animals that are no longer cute little cubs that people can come in and cuddle?
So in some ways, that's a $1 million question. Because the big cats trade in the U.S. is so poorly regulated, we don't have a clear-cut way to know what happens to each of these animals. Some of them will go into the pet trade, sold to people who may have good intentions, may think that they truly can somehow in their home care for one of these large dangerous animals, and they're unable to do so because there's this market of surplus adult big cats. Some of them will go to other pseudo sanctuaries to be bred or displayed. Some are killed to make space for new cats. And again, we don't know what happens to many of them because they're so poorly regulated, but the truth is there is a global trade in tiger parts and products and parts and products of the other big cats that we're hoping to see better regulated in the U.S. We certainly can't demonstrate that those parts and products, which have a high value in trade, are not entering that trade. And even if that's not the case, having those animals be out there with no regulation of what happens to them and to their parts and products once they die really takes away our credibility when we're trying to positively influence conservation practices abroad, when we're trying to help to rein in this global trade in big cat parts and products. It does not serve us well to say everybody else should clean up their side of the street, but we're going to leave our big cats mess over here.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that part of it. That's a big part of it. We need to set the example and certainly abide by what we're asking everybody else to do.
Certainly. And, the cub handling issue is one that really breaks my heart. And it's part of the reason that the bill that we're working on, the Big Cat Public Safety Act, one of its key aims is to prohibit direct contact displays, which allow members of the public to come into contact with juvenile lions, tigers, and other animals with which they might want to take a selfie or have a play experience. Because the truth is, speed breeding these animals, which is a horrific process both for the mother and for the cubs, which are torn away from the mother basically immediately after birth, really drives the speed breeding and trade in these animals. And so if we can help to keep the public's hands off of these big cats and make that a less profitable endeavor, then we can help to bring an end to the overall problem of the big cats trade, as well as the cruelty that's specific to the cub handling.
It's almost like the puppy trade, the puppy mills.
You know, it really is. And I've certainly heard colleagues of mine, and I'm sure I have myself used the phrase tiger mills.
Yeah.
A female tiger used for this purpose will be bred many, many more times than a female would breed in the wild. Mm-hmm. A female tiger might have a litter once every 2 years or so in the wild, in captivity. When she's being speed bred for purposes of cub handling exhibits, she may be having 6 times that many litters. And that's in part because her cubs are torn away from her so quickly that she can be put back into a reproductive cycle. And so every stage of the process is heartbreaking in terms of the physiological consequences and the psychological and emotional consequences.
Yeah, that's... Another thing I was wondering. Okay, so far we've talked mostly about tigers. Are there is there the same issue with lions and jaguars, leopards, even American animals like the mountain lions or the bobcats? As are they all under this duress?
They are. You know, tigers are the animals we see most frequently exploited in this way. And again, because of the weak regulations, we don't have precise numbers of animals are being abused under each species category in this way. But we do know it's also happening to lions and other species. In fact, there's in some of these sort of unscrupulous exhibits, we'll see a lot of hybridization. So crossbreeding of lions and tigers to create what some might call Frankencats, mm-hmm. as you would, of course, never find them in the wild. The species ranges generally don't overlap. And crossbreeding them in this way creates physiological problems for the animals. And it really misguides the public about what true conservation is. To say that breeding a lion with a tiger has kind of conservation value really misinforms people about what they can be doing with their good intentions toward promoting conservation.
Animals like tigers in the wild are generally solitary animals. When you look at these sanctuaries, even the ones that are valid, just by necessity, they're putting them together in the same habitat. Does that create an issue as well?
So that's an excellent question. And a true sanctuary will not put animals together unless they have been, for instance, rescued together and are already bonded to one another.
Okay.
Be introduced in a way that is to the animal's benefit. So they don't, for instance, rescue an animal, show up at their facility and just put the animal into an enclosure with existing big cats.
Right.
But to the extent the animals can be introduced and share space, for some, that stimulation can be good for them. But again, it can't be done haphazardly. And in general, enclosure space is managed very, very, very carefully, a true sanctuary. In fact, we work with a coalition that's called the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. And when we help to organize a rescue, we engage with partner sanctuaries across the U.S. to determine who has space for these animals. Mm-hmm. Evaluating where that space is available is a very, very serious discussion for all of the experts involved who have veterinary backgrounds, who have animal care expertise, and who have been through that process many times. On the other hand, I would say the process is not so carefully managed at pseudo-sanctuaries. And indeed, in some cases, you will see animals harming one another. We've seen animals with pretty serious injuries from being enclosed with other animals with whom they're not compatible and simply just experience a great deal of physical conflict. And again, in some cases, we'll see pseudo-sanctuaries killing off animals to make cage space to bring might be a more profitable cat to exhibit, whereas at a true sanctuary, you're never going to see that happen.
Right. And so do these pseudo-sanctuaries, are they part of the canned hunting industry? Do we have that here in the United States where people that are looking for trophy animals to hunt and they don't want to actually do any work, they go to these pseudo-sanctuaries and just shoot the animals in their pens?
That's a great question. So I certainly can't claim to have evidence of cant hunting going on in the U.S., these big cat species. Now, there's certainly speculation surrounding that. But again, I don't want to make a claim that I can't support. That said, I think this sort of brings us back to the influence that our problematic big cat trade here in the U.S., the implications that it has for the global trade exploitation of big cats. For nations that do openly offer cant hunting opportunities and regions that offer such opportunities, it's a little bit difficult for us to say, please stop this inhumane and anti-conservation practice. We're allowing this broad range of inhumane and exploitative practices to go on here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. or not, they include cant hunting here. You know, everybody has, you know, different feelings about different individual practices, but the truth is speed breeding a mother tiger to and tearing away her young to be handled for photo ops is cruel, just as some might consider cant hunting. And so, again, it gets back to the broader issue of our credibility globally.
Right. How did this become such a humongous issue here?
That is a wonderful question. So, essentially, because these big cats are so poorly regulated, in terms of the way that they're traded and records are kept, and because there is a good deal of money to be made by some exploitative businesses by allowing direct contact displays and trading these animals for exhibits that are operating in ways that we would discourage, the money drives a good deal of it. In defense of the public that has patronized these businesses, oftentimes they're taking advantage of people like us, people who love animals why they want to be near them. And they're just misleading those consumers and telling them that by taking a photo with this tiger cub, you're somehow helping it. By supporting this excessive breeding, you're supporting conservation because these are imperiled species. And so being able to essentially take advantage of consumers in that way and bring in a good amount of money by doing that, it's really fueled this business.
I can totally see how animal lovers would be fooled by a lot of the ploys that they use.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't know, if you're not even aware that this stuff exists, you would never think that somebody's doing something like that, unless it's really obvious when you go to the place and it's just completely awful.
Definitely. And, yeah. You know, the truth is a number of many of the pseudo sanctuaries that operate in the U.S. have learned how to cover their tracks very effectively, mm-hmm. learned how to tell lies about conservation that are really engaging to conservation-minded consumers or to humane-minded consumers. And I always try to convey the message that anybody who has been to one of these displays, if you've gone to a roadside menagerie, or you've had your photo taken and put it on a social media site holding a juvenile tiger, you should not, don't feel ashamed of that. Mm-hmm. You surely thought you were doing the right thing. So instead of, you know, digging in or feeling guilty or ashamed, just take it down or maybe, you know, take it down and explain to people why you took it down and maybe encourage others to do the same. And, you know, if you want to make it up to that big cat, then call your members of Congress and say, I'm urging you to support the Big Cat Public Safety Act to bring an end to the exploitation of U.S. big cats.
Okay, so you're a lawyer, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you're involved in helping to promote and draw up new policies to put an end to a lot of this stuff. What is the hesitation you see with government officials getting these kind of things done? It just seems so commonsensical that we would not want, you know, this kind of illegal pet trade going on. I mean, I read on your website that there are more big cats in captivity here than there are, like tigers specifically. I think you said there are more than 10,000 big cats in captivity here. And more tigers here than in the wild.
Right. And again, those are sort of broad estimates because we don't really have a way to know how many are here. But circling back to your question about why it's so difficult to change federal policy, certainly I wish that weren't the case. But in broad terms, federal policy, I think, moves just much more slowly than many of us would like. In this very divisive time, I think it's very heartening to reflect on the fact that the Big Cat Public Safety Act has strong bipartisan support in both chambers of Congress, which shows that, again, not only is this animal welfare and conservation issue something that's bringing together some allies that may not often work together in Congress. And that credit, the credit for that really goes to the public, to the people who called their members of Congress and said, please support the Big Cat Public Safety Act. I think it feels very mundane. It's an unglamorous activity. It's an unglamorous ask. I understand that. And we're asked every day to contact our legislators about something, but it truly, truly makes a difference. So to those who have taken that action, you have really helped get this bill to where it is with huge co-sponsorship, again, in both chambers, with support from all parties. And I would encourage those who have not taken that action yet to please call your members of Congress and say, please support the Big Cat Public Safety Act.
Yeah, that's really good to know, because I think you never know if you're making a difference or not by contacting your representative.
I promise you are making a difference when you contact your member of Congress. If I go into a legislative office and say, will you co-sponsor this bill? One of the most important determining factors to where they land is how many constituents they've heard from. It's easy, again, in these sort of divisive times, I think, for all of us to become a little jaded about politics. But the truth is, you should remember that your legislators work for you, mm-hmm. and it's your job to tell them what to do.
Right. And so do you spend a lot of your time in Washington, running up and down the Capitol steps, visiting senators' offices and stuff?
Well, yes, in non-COVID times, in recent times, it's been a Zoom version of that. But yes, we do work directly with legislators and with legislative staff. And again, I think it's easy to be cynical about politics, but it's heartening to know that there are legislators, including the leaders, the bipartisan leaders of the Big Cat Public Safety Act, who really, really, really care about this, that there are compassion-minded leaders on Capitol Hill. And again, they need to just hear from their constituents and be reminded that it's also a priority for them.
That's really, really good to know. Do you ever get involved in actual rescues that are done?
Yeah. So my counterpart, on our animal rescue team, Meredith Whitney, is the expert on this. And she has a million wonderful stories that, frankly, I tend to bring her into my policy discussions because everybody would rather hear about the tiger rescue than the nuances of amendments to the Lacey Act. But yeah, we engage in rescues across the U.S. Again, we partner with the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance and our phenomenal sanctuary partners who just do incredible work 24 hours per day, 365 days per year. And it's really heartening to be able to rescue some of these animals who come from just horrific conditions. Some of them are emaciated, have really been denied any proper nutrition. Almost all have been denied proper veterinary care. We see some that had been mangled, essentially, in attempts to make them safe as pets, meaning they've been declawed and defanged, which are cruel procedures to begin with, but oftentimes they're done without even any semblance of veterinary care involved. And so we've just seen some very, very gruesome conditions from which these animals can come. And it is heartening to see the way that they can recover, the way their lives can change, and they can be resilient once they get to a true sanctuary and are given as close to a natural life as they can have. Because, of course, these animals can never be released into the wild. They never lived there. But, where they can be given proper veterinary care, expert nutritional guidance, individualized diets that reflect the poor physical conditions that they experienced earlier in life. And so it's always motivating to see those rescues, again, that happen across the United States. But it's also important to remember that sadly, those are the lucky few that get rescued and get to go live at these qualified sanctuaries where they receive fantastic care. And they're emblematic of many, many, many more like them that never get to have that experience, that will just spend their lives being traded among pseudo sanctuaries or private owners And again, we'll never get to have sort of a happy ending. Yeah. And the sanctuary's goal that we work with, they all would like to, as I suppose we would like to, put themselves out of business, you know, the hope will no longer be a need for that kind of rescue.
Right. And so what is a sanctuary school? Is that where people that want to open a sanctuary go to get proper training to do a proper sanctuary?
Sanctuaries, some of the best guidance can come from the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, and they're sort of an accrediting body for true sanctuaries. And part of the goal of the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance is for sanctuaries to share best practices with one another. And so the sanctuaries with which we partner already, for the most part, have, you know, very impressive veterinary expertise, in many cases, on-site veterinary clinics, detailed emergency response plans, you know, and all these unique enrichment activities that can be quite adorable to watch when they're in play. And so they bring in experts from academia, again, you know, veterinary care professionals, et cetera, but also learn from one another about the best ways to protect animals and give them quality lifetime care.
Right. So do they meet, do they like have a forum or some kind of meeting that they do like on a regular basis where they trade ideas and things like that with each other?
Yeah. So they have essentially a constant forum going on through the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. It has committees that focus on a whole range of issues. I work most closely with their advocacy committee because, like I said, these sanctuaries, in addition to caring for the animals, want to make sure the Big Cat Public Safety Act becomes law. But they have committees to focus on a range of animal care issues and sanctuary operation issues and really use that sort of constant communication to keep one another informed about best practices, as well as rescue opportunities. And then they have biannual meetings, or at least pre-COVID, there were biannual meetings in person. And they also make sure to engage in other animal care gatherings. Mm-hmm. There's, for instance, a regular meeting held by the Performing Animal Welfare Society, which is one of our partner sanctuaries that operates out of California. And they hold a biannual conference as well to help share ideas and bring attention to the issues that captive exploited animals in the U.S. encounter.
Wow. I mean, it's a huge, huge, overwhelming job.
It truly is. And I have extraordinary respect for the sanctuary operators, personnel, staff, everybody involved with the true sanctuaries, because there are no vacation days. There's no sleeping in. There's no Saturday. They dedicate every moment of their lives to providing these animals with the best care possible. And they see the difficult conditions from which the animals come. You know, they see the heartbreak, and I think it's very motivating. But, you know, certainly I would encourage anybody watching to support IFAW, but certainly if you have a chance to visit a sanctuary or support a sanctuary that's accredited by the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, or as a member of the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance, I encourage you to do so, to learn more about these animals, because I can speak to this sort of macro issue, but there really is nothing like hearing these individual animal stories and seeing the way their lives are changed once they reach a true sanctuary.
How many of these sanctuaries are there, the accredited ones or the valid ones?
Oh, that's such a good question.
In the U.S., yeah.
I don't have a number off the top of my head. I mean, true sanctuaries, certainly the number pales in comparison to the number of pseudo sanctuaries, unfortunately. So we might be looking at maybe 15 true sanctuaries in the U.S. I mean, don't quote me on that, but I would encourage people again to visit the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance website, where you can see sort of a list of our partner sanctuaries and the work that they do. And the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries also has an interactive map if you're looking to find out about sanctuaries in your region.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Okay. How do you guys find out about animals that need rescuing?
So there are a whole range of ways in which we find out about the need for an animal to be rescued from inhumane or otherwise dangerous or inappropriate circumstances. And the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance was actually established to streamline that process, so that, you know, if an animal were confiscated in one circumstance by an animal care or law enforcement agency, if an animal got loose in a community and were captured by an animal control organization, or if somebody were surrendering an animal. There was a time when this was, I don't want to say haphazard process, but there certainly wasn't a streamlined process for coordinating with qualified sanctuaries, transport specialists, veterinary specialists. And so now we've done outreach to the various entities that might need support for rescues to try and educate them about the Big Cat Sanctuary Alliance. And then once that need for rescue is introduced into the coalition, the wheels go into motion and the logistics are just amazing to watch. Different sanctuaries are involved with the transport process, with the veterinary care process, with the actual securing of the facility from which the animals are coming. Just every stage of the process is so intensely thought out because these are dangerous animals and they're often in very poor condition. And so it really takes a village, I suppose you could say, to facilitate the rescue of even a single animal.
You all have some great videos of that. I don't know which one it was that I was watching, but it was some tigers being rescued from a really horrible situation. And like you say, it was like watching a well-oiled machine, and there were so many moving parts to it, things that had to have been well coordinated and thought out, and it was really impressive to watch.
Yeah, thank you. And that, I believe, was our Seized series, where we think it's a 6-part series on our YouTube channel. And you can watch sort of the progression of this rescue and see all that goes into it. And you're right, that really underscores how many moving parts there are, with sometimes with first responders involved, with veterinary professionals, our partner sanctuaries, our rescue coordinators. And I will say that is a great one to watch because those animals ended up very happy. And I think it's always, in my view, nice to see the happy endings of some of those rescues where you can see them later on at the sanctuary. Perhaps the sanctuary at which they end up will post videos of them just rolling around and playing with their enrichment toys and living as wildly as they can.
I imagine for some, it's maybe the first time they've been out on grass.
Yes. But it's unfortunately a first for many of them to have almost any natural experience, be that having proper food, or encountering grass, or having spaces to sort of hide or feel safe or be away from view. Again, I realize much of this conversation is a bit sad, and it's true. The big cats trade in the U.S. is heartbreaking. But for those who, after reflecting on this, want a bit of a mood lifter, I would look up some of the enrichment activities that go on at our partner sanctuaries. And they get very creative. During the holidays, for instance, they will have, they use materials that are safe for the animals in case they ingest them. You know, they'll have gift wrap, catnip boxes. And the tigers in particular love to play with pumpkins in pools that they have in their enclosures because tigers love water and they love to play. So it's just very cute to watch them tackle pumpkins around Halloween time. So they get to have fun once they're rescued.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so if an animal is rescued and cannot be put in with another animal, so say there's you have a tiger, that tiger has to go into its own habitat, but it's been terribly abused, horrible conditions. Because there's no human, I guess that's kind of different. There's no human handling. They're still able to recover on their own naturally just because of the good environment and the support they're getting.
Yes. And some of the behavioral shifts that we see in the rescued animals really underscore their amazing resilience. First, if an animal can't be safely placed in with another animal, if it's just not suited, if it can't happily be placed in with another animal, it will be put in its own enclosure. An enclosure will be built for it. We've helped to fund the construction of new enclosures in just such circumstances. But positive reinforcement methods that don't involve any type of direct contact are sometimes used to help the animals become trusting again. They begin to be fed well, again, not through direct contact, but they are given the opportunity to roam, to get comfortable. And some of them will always be a bit temperamental and uncomfortable. And those ones are just given as much space as possible. And it's understandable that some of these animals will always prefer not to see people very much, aside perhaps from when they're being fed. And so for those animals, they're given the opportunity to have as much solitude, space, peace, enrichment resources, whatever they need to live as well as they can for the remainder of their lives.
It's pretty incredible that they can recover from those things.
It really is. It's really, again, I can't encourage people enough to go watch some of our partner sanctuaries videos. If you're looking for a place to start, I would certainly say the Wild Sanctuary up in Minnesota has a very active social media presence, and they just have some wonderful footage of some of their rescued animals.
That's called the Wild Cat Sanctuary in Minnesota?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Okay, so I want to go a little bit dark again.
Sure. Well, we are trying to fix the problem.
We're trying to fix the problem, yeah. You also work with the trapping and hunting issues. Does that only include the cats, or do you do wolves and things like that as well?
Yeah, so our coexistence work at IFA here in the U.S. focuses largely on native species, on helping people to coexist with and make sure they're humanely approaching management of native canids are a group of species we often talk about, you know, wolves, coyotes, et cetera. But in general, we're encouraging people as well as we can to coexist with the animals that they live alongside, whether that be in an urban or suburban setting or in a rural community or an agricultural landscape, whatever it may be, coexistence is something that we're trying to support nationwide.
I think that's huge globally. That's really the key to taking care of a lot of these problems, is figuring out a coexistence strategy.
I will say it connects to big cats in the sense that there are parts of the world where we've worked with communities, or we observe communities who successfully live alongside lions and are safeguard their community as well as live alongside these truly dangerous animals. And certainly if that can be done, then we can live alongside coyotes.
And wolves, yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Now, so is that something you yourself work on, it, or do you just really do the cats?
So Big Cats is the campaign on which I'm most active, but I do work closely with my colleague, Mark Hofberg, who leads our wildlife coexistence campaign. And again, we do both sort of academic, educational work. We developed a coexistence report relatively recently. And then we also work on the policy side, trying to reform federal policy to better reflect those coexistence objectives.
Yeah, I know there's some, I think there's a, it's either happened and is finished now, or happened and is still going on, the big wolf slaughter that's happening right now. 1,000 wolves they're trying to get rid of. Of course, they just reintroduced them, and now that they're thriving, they're killing them all again. So,
and that's, we certainly oppose the slaughter of wolves. And wolves are understandably are extremely charismatic and are really, I think, representative of wild America to many people. I think many of us have a place in our heart for wolves, even if we've never seen one and may never see one in the wild. And what we focus on first is the cruelty, the methods by which people kill animals. It's not that we're directing people to never go hunting or engage in any consumptive use activities, but there are certain devices and activities that are simply, from our perspective, unacceptable.
Right.
Body gripping traps are one of them. And that's something where I think it does parallel the captive big cats issue, in the sense that many Americans don't realize that we're among the countries that still allow the use of leg hold traps, where an animal can, you know, struggle and just really experience excruciating suffering. Neck snares that can strangle them, drowning traps. I mean, I hate to even mention these things because I know it's so painful to think about, but I think we have to think about it.
We have to know about it.
Change.
We absolutely do.
And one opportunity, to sort of engage right now for those who want to do something about it, who want to help make change, is we're working on a piece of legislation called that will soon be reintroduced, called Canyon's Law. And this is an effort to bring an end to the use of certain dangerous wildlife poisons that are used across the U.S. And are largely used by a federal agency. So as far as insult to injury, not only are these devices putting communities and wildlife in danger, but they are, we are footing the bill for them.
Or is the government sanctioning these things?
Yeah, so there's a program called Wildlife Services that's housed within the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Uh-huh. And we are broadly working to reform that agency from calling for shifts of funding toward non-lethal coexistence tools. But this effort specifically, this legislative effort, is focused on bringing an end to the use of two deadly poisons, the most commonplace of which is sodium cyanide that's used in devices called M44s, or colloquially cyanide bombs, is a word people have coined for them. And they're very neutral looking. They don't look dangerous when you see them. It looks like a little sprinkler head, even if you happen to notice it. It's innocuous. But they're baited and they're designed so that when an animal approaches it and tugs on it or otherwise interferes with it, sodium cyanide powder will be ejected into the animal's mouth, then killing it. And so, first of all, we object to that in the first place. This is not a humane way to be managing animals. But it's also an extremely poorly targeted way to be managing animals. So most of these are not reaching the animals they're intended to kill. They harm a great deal of non-target wildlife. They've killed numerous pets and even poisoned people. And the reason this effort, this legislative effort, has been called Canyon's Law is because a young man in Idaho named Canyon, he and his dog were poisoned by one of these devices near their home. And Canyon, you know, suffered long-term health consequences, and his dog Casey died right in front of him. And so he and his family have joined our fight and said, we're not going to allow this to happen to other families. So again, that bill will be reintroduced soon. And for those who wish to help with that effort, call your members of Congress and say, please support Canyon's Law and help us protect communities and wildlife alike.
That's great. So when you're doing this work, what is the thing you like most to do? Like, what if you come into work and there's a project that's come up, is there something that you hope it's going to be? Like, is there something that really floats your boat?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So in terms of substance, certainly it's been exciting to engage on efforts to defend the U.S. Endangered Species Act. In recent years, there have been a number of efforts, both administratively and legislatively, to really undermine the critically, critically important provisions of that bill. Despite it being, you know, hugely supported among the public, hugely successful in terms of success rate in protecting species, and something that's really, really critical in terms of using federal policy tools to protect wildlife. That's changed a little bit. I think members of Congress and others are starting to better understand the importance of safeguarding the Endangered Species Act, but it's been nice to see that awareness sort of spread and us maybe not having to take quite as defensive a posture on that. I will say something that I think is very exciting is to see young people getting involved in these issues broadly. I think a great example in the big cats context is there's a group of students called Tigers for Tigers. And it's a student organization that started at Clemson University.
Oh, my son went there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's so funny.
Well, and the Tigers for Tigers slogan is "Save our mascot."
Wow.
They work with tiger mascot school, other tiger mascot schools, and Tigers for Tigers students on campus help to educate their fellow students. They do awareness events. They engage fellow students in conservation activities and in legislative activities. You know, contact your member of Congress. And it really helps to channel that existing strong school spirit, which I'm sure you well from Clemson.
Huge.
Yeah, translates it into protecting these animals in tangible ways. And efforts like that, I think, are just really wonderful and give me a lot of hope for what's to come.
Yeah, that's incredible. Now, so do you all do outreach to schools yourselves? Do you go to like elementary schools or high schools or anything like that to educate?
So we don't do a ton of that directly, in part because we're just not a huge staff, but certainly would love to have an opportunity to do that. We do have certain educational resources that are available to teachers and that can be sort of be used as educational packets with sort of teaching guides and visuals and some things that can be kind of fun to engage kids with. But we do, I would say our education efforts are probably focused more on adults at the time, but certainly I value any opportunity we get to work with young people and teach them about these issues.
Yeah. Well, I'm super excited to hear about the Clemson involvement.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, it's really great. And so suitable too, since they are so spirit oriented and the tiger is their mascot. Yeah. Why is the government so, why is this even questioned by the government, the Endangered Species Act? Why is that even questioned as something that's, is it just, is it a bargaining tool that's used a lot where, you know, if you put this aside, I'll give you this, and it just kind of is low priority and gets swept aside a lot? I mean, it just seems so clearly obvious.
The controversy surrounding the Endangered Species Act is one of what's in the interest of the American public. Survey data shows us that Americans in very, very large numbers support the Endangered Species Act. And we also know that the Endangered Species Act has been successful in protecting nearly every single animal that's ever been listed. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of some members of the public hating it and some members liking it. It's more a matter of land development in some cases, fossil fuel development in some cases, just objections to regulating certain landscapes. I'm trying to think of a diplomatic way to say it, but truthfully, it's generally an industry versus the public and wildlife interest.
So it's money. Money is the winner.
Yeah. Yes. And this is, but even to say it that way, the money involved, in my view at least, is being a bit exaggerated by opponents of the act. Their argument as far as what's at stake, as I understand it, I think exaggerates the financial considerations. And really undervalues, of course, again, the fact that the public values this law so, so much. There are very few statutes that we can do surveying on where we see such a consensus among the American public, which is heartening. And so, again, it's been nice to see that it seems increasingly legislators, not all of them, but it seems increasingly that more and more are willing to listen to their constituents when it comes to the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it's an uphill battle though, with industries that are potentially going to lose business and money over the act being passed.
Yeah. You know, it's true. I think that's in part on us to find creative ways to bridge some of those barriers that seem difficult to bridge. I think a great example is our right whale, our North Atlantic right whale protection program. Uh-huh. We work alongside lobstermen in the Northeast who I guess you could consider a potential opponent, but we actually have evaluated and identified our sort of overlapping interests and worked alongside them to protect the North Atlantic right whale. And I think, if we continue to find creative ways to work alongside non-traditional partners, we can really help to reinforce the Endangered Species Act and better protect individual species.
Yeah, I think that's so great. That's really great. The creativity is really crucial in getting a lot of this taken care of and coming back to sort of the coexistence with the wild animals and human populations. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's super exciting what you're doing. I really admire it so much. And I appreciate that people like you are around to spearhead these movements, because it's really key for everybody.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And certainly same to you.
Well, is there anything you want to add? I've taken up a lot of your time and I don't want to keep you for any longer than, you know, I said. So is there anything you want to add?
Well, of course, just thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed speaking with you. And I guess if I can give one final pitch, it's just to reinforce that I know it doesn't sound exciting, but it really, really matters when you contact your members of Congress. Please contact your members of Congress today and ask them to support the Big Cat Public Safety Act. This is something we can really get done in this Congress if we all take action today.
That sounds great. I'm going to do it. And I'm so glad to hear that it actually works to contact your congressman. That's great. Well, I am going to put all the information at the back of the video, and that gives everybody a chance to donate and to go on the website and check out all the different stories, all the different projects that the International Fund for Animal Welfare is doing all over the world, and particularly your work with the big cats and the rescuing. Hopefully we'll get a lot of people on board now that they know what's happening.
Yeah, thank you again so much. It's so nice talking with you.
It was great talking to you too, Carson.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington, production by Stacy Spencer of Going Graphic, sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media, and music written and performed by Jake Shepard.